would first call Clinton Ray Griffin versus the State of Texas, cause number 17291CR. Do we have the attorneys present for the case?
Rick Wetzel from the state, Your Honor.
Morning, Ms. Wetzel. Good morning. Very well, Ms. Humphrey. If you all want to come up to the tables and be getting comfortable, we'll go ahead and also call the second case in advance. Silicone Laboratories et al. Versus the Comptroller's Office, CV 17061. We're going to make announcements for that case.
Your Honor, Silicone Labs is ready.
Very good.
State officials are ready, Your Honor.
Very good, Mr. Hungarden. For those of you new to the third court, which I don't think anybody is, each side will be allocated 20 minutes to argue. You should have gotten with the clerk already to figure out how you want to divide up your time as far as reserving time for rebuttal, et cetera. I understand in the second case we have an interesting time allotment, so I'll make sure that you guys get with the clerk and get that straight away. We have a time warning system. When the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes left in your allocated time. When the red light comes on, you are out of time and need to find a stopping point. By way of observation, we have a group of Westlake seniors here with us today for career day to observe arguments, and so let's not poison them on wanting to be lawyers. Let's all conduct ourselves in such a way that we look good. And also, if anyone has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off during the arguments, if you would at this time silence that device. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys in the Griffin case. Also forgot to mention, we have a relatively new system whereby we record oral arguments, and so if you can, make sure and speak into the microphone, and just be aware that your arguments are being recorded, and then later they will be on the court's website for download if you care to listen to them. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Karen Opria, representing the appellant, Clinton Griffin. Mr. Griffin was adjudicated guilty based on 6 allegations of violations of his community service. Those allegations fall into 3 categories, and I'd like to address each of them in turn. The first is the failure by Mr. Griffin to make his financial payments as he was ordered to do by the terms of his community supervision. At the revocation hearing, the state was required to prove and failed to prove the element of intent as established by our common law. Historically, Texas has imposed a common law burden on the state to prove both that a defendant had the ability to pay, make his financial payments, and also that he intentionally did not make those payments. And what the case law says is that the legislature can take away one or the other of those burdens, but not both. In 1977, the legislature altered the traditional common law burden by making ability to pay an affirmative defense. And what the Court of Criminal Appeals said in response to that legislation is very important. In Stanfield versus State, the court said that it would not interpret that legislation to take away the burden of proving intent from the state. In other words, the legislature can remove the burden as to one or the other, but not both, and the Court of Criminal Appeals would not interpret it to be doing so. And what the Stanfield court thought was that it would be unconstitutional to remove both of those burdens from the state. And so it interpreted that legislation in a constitutional light. Now, in 2007, the legislature put the burden back on the state to prove ability to pay for some types of financial obligations. But it says nothing about fines and restitution. And so what the state is saying is that the ability to pay fines must now be meaningless because the legislature left them out of that statute. But it left them out of the 1977 statute as well. And yet that burden to prove intent survived that legislation, both for the items that were listed in the statute and those that were left out.
Do we have case law post the last legislative enactment that shows that what you're saying is still correct after the enactment?
Well, in Gibson versus State, the Court of Criminal Appeals was remanding a case. This is in 2012. And they said the Court of Appeals may want to consider the viability of this common law burden after the 2007 changes to the statute. But my search of the case law shows that it hasn't been really addressed directly yet.
Even in Gibson, when they remanded it and it came back, it seemed to get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, that's what happened. The Court of Appeals issued their decision based on a statutory interpretation. Then when the PDR went back up, the common law issue wasn't in front of the court. So it has sort of been left out there.
I was going to ask you that. Was it in front of the Court of Criminal Appeals when it came back up and they just didn't reach it, or was it just not raised? Do you know?
They say in a footnote that it's the Court of Appeals decided it and it's not in front of them. So they didn't make a affirmative statement about that. But what Stanfield is saying is intent, the burden of intent is sort of a constitutional floor or constitutional minimum burden that we put on the state. And it's saying that this is for constitutional reasons. And so even if we look at this new statute as taking away the burden from the state to prove ability to pay for fines and restitution, Stanfield would say that that burden to prove intent should remain for constitutional reasons. And so if we look at the hearing itself, the state did fail to prove intent. All of the evidence showed that Mr. Griffin was indigent. He was living well below the poverty line. He had no significant assets. And yet he was looking for work, and he was working. And so this is a sufficiency issue. The trial court shouldn't have revoked Mr. Griffin when the state failed to meet this burden of proving intent. Now, even if we set aside the issue of what was the state's burden at the revocation hearing, there's also a separate independent duty on the part of the trial court judge to inquire into and take into consideration the willfulness of a probationer's failure to make his financial payments. And that's under Bearden versus Georgia, a U.S. Supreme Court case. And what that case says is if a probationer did not willfully fail to make his payments, then the trial court judge can't resort to imprisonment as a form of punishment unless there are no other viable options. And so if we look at this hearing, the trial court judge did not take the Bearden factors into consideration, and so that was an abuse of discretion.
And they have to vocalize those on the record? Or can we infer from the trial court's conclusion?
Yes, the case law shows that there needs to be affirmative evidence that the trial court judge is taking the factors into consideration, and there also has to be evidence on the record to support his determination. So even if we get past the willfulness issue, there's no evidence that there were no alternatives to incarceration in this case. And I wanted to touch on the issue of preservation here because that's something the state's talking about in its brief. Bryant versus State is the controlling case here. In Bryant, the probationer had introduced evidence of his finances, his assets, his employment. And then he argued to the court, I should not be revoked because I'm unable to make my payments. And the Bryant defendant did not couch his arguments in a particular statute. He didn't properly state the burdens of proof or the underlying law. Even on appeal, he failed to do that. And what the court said was he was not required to use any specific words or cite a particular source of law. What mattered was that he told the trial court that his inability to pay was the reason why he shouldn't be revoked. And so the court said it's his evidence and his argument that made it obvious that ability to pay was his defense. That was enough to preserve the law that applied to that argument. And so the court considered, in that case, the requirements of the restitution statute that applied and also looked at Bearden versus Georgia. And so under Bryant, in this case, the Bearden claim is preserved. Mr. Griffin introduced evidence of his finances, his assets, and his employment, his income, and then said to the trial court judge, don't revoke me because I was unable to pay. And so whether we look at this from the perspective of the state's burden of proof, or we look at this from the perspective of what was the trial court's independent duty, it was an abuse of discretion to adjudicate Mr. Griffin guilty, based on failure to make his financial payments.
Even moving beyond the payment of the fines, if we find that there's sufficient evidence to support any one of the grounds the trial court stated we have to affirm, correct?
That's the way the law is now.
If one question I have, there's a ground that the trial court specifically found was not met, number two.
That's right.
But then the judgment doesn't delineate that. The judgment actually, the written judgment rather, actually states that the trial court found all, and it says C motion, state's motion, which appears to incorporate everything. Given that, what can we do, or what are the bounds that we're presented with regard to ground number two?
I haven't done research on exactly that issue for this argument, but I believe the rule is that the oral pronouncement controls over the written, and I can provide the court with some case law on that. But the allegation that he specifically orally said was not proven can't be the basis for sustaining this revocation on appeal. And I think if the court looks to the evidence, the trial court did that because there was testimony that he had in fact fulfilled all of his community supervision obligations.
If you would actually send us a letter on that.
Sure.
And specifically address the LaBoy case out of this court. LaBoy versus State, L-A-B-O-Y versus State.
LaBoy versus State.
And how you would need to distinguish that case.
Sure. Moving on to the allegation that Mr. Griffin went within 1,000 feet of a child safety zone when he went near the Johnson County Christian Lodge. Condition 29 does forbid him from going within 1,000 feet of a place where children gather, is what the terms say. And so the state was required to prove, number one, that he went within 1,000 feet of the lodge, as it alleged. But number two, it was required to prove that the lodge was a place where children gather. And so what the state did at the hearing was they proved that Mr. Griffin gave evidence that he did go near this lodge, but they didn't offer any evidence that it was a place where children gather. And so the state's evidence really amounts to the probation officer saying, yes, he committed what he called a child safety zone violation. How did he commit it? Well, he went to the lodge. So there are several problems with this evidence.
Did he call it a child safety zone, though?
What the state said, did you find out that he committed a child safety zone violation? And he said, yes. And then they said, how did you know that? And he said, well, he went near the lodge. And I think there are other places where he refers to child safety zone violations in the record. So a conclusory statement that a defendant violated a condition or even broke a law doesn't prove that he did. So we have cases like Harrington versus State, which I cite in my brief, where the Court of Criminal Appeals said testimony from a probation officer that a probationer moved without getting prior permission wasn't sufficient to prove that he changed his residence without getting prior permission. And the problem with evidence like that is there are no facts to show that conclusory statement is in fact true. And so that's the same problem we have here. So Murphy says the lodge was a child safety zone, but he doesn't give any facts to prove that it is the thing that he's calling it. And in fact, Murphy, the probation officer, never said that the phrase child safety zone actually meant place where children gather. No one at the hearing described the lodge as a place where children gather. But that's actually the language in the terms of the community supervision. It doesn't say child safety zone. But even if the lodge had been called a place where children gather, we'd still have the similar problem. Those phrases, child safety zone or place where children gather, those are concepts, and they're factually rich, and they involve underlying facts. And so there need to be some facts at this hearing showing that those concepts actually apply to that situation.
So you're saying that overlaps with the actual contact with children, that you have to show that there was contact or the children were present before those concepts can come into play?
Well, with the contact issue, the main problem with the contact issue is Mr. Griffin wasn't forbidden from having supervised contact with children. The provision just says if no unsupervised contact, unless you get this permission from your probation officer or your sex offender program director. And at the hearing, there was no evidence that he had this unsupervised contact. So in that case, it's a little more straightforward. He was revoked for having plain old contact when there's no evidence that it was unsupervised. And so the rules are, of course, you can only be revoked for a condition that was imposed by that trial court that you had notice of. So to go into the...
What about the contact, the testimony that I can't remember his name, but saw your client following the teenage girl out of the building? Why isn't that testimony alone enough to affirm on that ground?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, he was there, so that is supervised. But the other thing is construing...
Who was there?
This probation officer.
Yes.
Was walking up as
yeah.
they were walking out.
That's right. That's right.
And you're saying that that's supervision?
Well, I'm saying there's a third party present, and so we don't know who's present inside that building, and we do know that there's a probation officer present outside that building. Everybody said Mr. Griffin was walking to meet him. And so walking 10 to 15 feet apart from a child isn't contact under any reasonable definition of that word. I mean, that would happen anytime you go to the grocery store or go anywhere in the world, that would be contact. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. Mr. Wetzel?
Thank you. May it please the court. Rick Wetzel for the state on this revocation case before you this morning. Going through the grounds alleged as the basis of the revocation, the trial court revoked for 8 different reasons. The state has conceded 2 of those reasons weren't sufficiently proven. Those 2 reasons are the failure to pay attorney fees and the failure to pay a sexual assault program fee. It's my position that the remaining 6 allegations were sufficiently proven by a preponderance of the evidence, and that any one of those 6 would be sufficient to uphold the revocation and the adjudication. So in order for the appellant to prevail, she's got to run the table and win on every one of those claims. And I don't believe that's happened. First, let me talk a little bit about the ability to pay. And this goes to both the fine and the restitution. It's the state's position that there's no duty to prove an ability to pay. Statutorily, that has been dispensed with by the legislature, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said as much in the Gibson case with regard to fines. On the Bearden claim, that was defaulted. It wasn't raised at the hearing. The extent of the objection at the hearing was the state had not proven the ability to pay. Well, that's in the nature of a defensive issue. He never asked for a due process or equal protection consideration under Bearden versus Georgia, and that has been defaulted. And of course, you have the additional problem of you have non-financial violations here. So why would the court even need to hold a Bearden hearing in view of those non-financial violations?
Do you agree that there was a common law duty in Texas for the state to prove inability to pay in this type of situation?
I'm sorry?
In this situation?
I agree the case law recognized that. I think the legislature has done away with that. Under the rule of hierarchical governance, I think the statute controls over the common law.
And are you familiar with any cases that have construed that aside from Gibson? I guess in the same opportunity to submit a letter brief on that question?
I've looked, and okay. I haven't found any.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. Let me talk a little bit about the supervision. There were three different children involved in the unsupervised contact. And the testimony at the revocation hearing was pretty clear when the prosecutor asked the probation officer, what is supervision? Who does the supervision? And he made it clear that it was some court-approved chaperone. It wasn't a mother, it wasn't a father, it wasn't a grandfather, unless that person had been designated as a supervisor.
But what weight do we give that testimony if it's not congruent with the trial court's own terms of supervision? Because there's nothing in the trial court's terms that say anything other than no unsupervised visits. There's no definition.
That's correct. That means.
So what are we to do with testimony that provides a definition that's not in the trial court's order?
You give that testimony and the condition a common sense interpretation. And that would be supervision means something other than an adult. Someone qualified to supervise. I mean, you've got to remember the underlying basis of the charge in this case, and there were concerns about him being around children. And simply having a grandma or a father there without more wouldn't be sufficient to protect the children. And that was the basis of the condition. To the extent the condition was uncertain, there's no indication he ever sought clarification. There was no challenge at the revocation hearing to vagueness or indefiniteness. So to the extent that claim is raised now, I think it's waived and can't be raised for the first time on appeal. So you have repeated unsupervised contact with children. Those are three violations in and of themselves.
If it is vague, though, whose problem is that? Isn't that the state's problem as they try to enforce it against him?
In what respect?
The level of supervision, like who qualifies as his supervisor, if that's not defined within the terms of the order.
It is.
Like you're trying to read something into that that doesn't seem to be in the order.
Well, the probation officer defined it during the revocation hearing, defined what supervision means. And there's no indication Griffin ever sought clarification on what supervision means.
Is there evidence that Griffin was told what it means before the revocation hearing?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Is there evidence in the record that shows that Griffin knew what the probation officer thought it meant before they showed up for the revocation hearing? In other words, do we have evidence that that was ever explained anywhere?
We have admissions by Griffin evidencing consciousness of violations. He told the probation officer he violated the child safety zone provision. He violated the uncontact supervision provision with regard to his niece and nephew. So to the extent he was confused, he wasn't so confused that he couldn't admit that he violated those conditions. Does that answer your question?
No, it's probably the only answer that there is to the question.
Okay, I agree. Let me move on to the child safety zone or place where children gather claim. He was revoked and adjudicated for going to some place called the Christian Lodge, which apparently is a women's shelter in Johnson County in Cleburne. And the appellant argues, I need to get out of that habit. The appellant argues that there was no proof that children have ever gathered there. I will concede it's not as strong as it could be, but the legislature has recognized a child safety zone and set out elements of a child safety zone or conditions of probation which need to be imposed in order to protect children. We have the admission by Griffin that he violated the child safety zone, so he knew where he was supposed to go and not go. And finally, just under a preponderance of the evidence standard, I think it's a reasonable deduction for the trial court to find that children gather at a women's shelter. And I don't know where they're going to leave their kids with their abusive spouse or abusive partner when they run off to the women's shelter. So I think that was a reasonable deduction by the trial court. Let me briefly mention, and the appellant didn't mention this, but I want to mention it. In three different grounds, he seeks revocation of the judgment or the order adjudicating guilt. Wants to get rid of the fine because it wasn't orally pronounced. The state agrees with that. Wants to get rid of the restitution because it wasn't orally pronounced. The state agrees with that. Excuse me. And he wants to get rid of the attorney fees because of an inability to pay. The state agrees insofar as the attorney fees from the revocation, not from the original deferred. There was about $6,200 on the original deferred. He waived that. He can't raise it for the first time on the adjudication.
What about the $2,070 of other court costs?
I don't have a position on that, Your Honor. The state's primary concern is to see the adjudication upheld. In terms of money concerns, I ran through those, but if some of that money needs to go away, that's fine. But he needs to do his 17 years in prison. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Rebuttal, Ms. Apre.
I'd like to address this argument that the probation officer could be somehow an authority on what the condition said. The case law and the statutes are very clear that it's only the trial court that can impose or modify conditions. So if the probation officer...
Well, but the probation officer is the extension of the court and is the one that's responsible for administering the conditions.
Absolutely. He is...
And supervising the probationer while they're trying to execute those conditions.
That's right. He has a lot of responsibilities. But one thing we know from the cases is he can't change the conditions. He can't alter or modify them. That authority lies solely with the trial court. And so the authority that we have here is those conditions themselves that the trial court imposed. He wrote them down. That's what Mr. Griffin had notice of. So,
well, but the one condition quite specifically reads, and I'll quote it, have no unsupervised contact with any person 17 years of age or younger unless approved by your community supervision officer and approved by the sex offender treatment provider.
Absolutely. And the issue in this case is that word unsupervised. And so the plain language of that term says, if you want to have unsupervised contact with children, you better go get this permission or you're in violation. But supervised contact is not forbidden. And so when the probation officer gets up there and says, no, that term forbade supervised and unsupervised, he doesn't have the authority to change those or to modify those. And so what's our ultimate authority is, what did that trial court do? That's considered a contract with Mr. Griffin. And so the plain language of that is this unsupervised versus supervised distinction. And So I think also the state's characterizing Mr. Griffin as admitting that he committed violations or that what he did was a violation. But I think if the court looks at the record, what was happening was he was asked questions like, did you go to the lodge? And he said, yes, I did. So that's not saying I committed a child safety zone violation or I violated my conditions. He's just saying, yes, I'm not denying that I went to this place. So I think it's an overstatement to describe that as I'm admitting that I violated this condition. What he's doing is saying, I'm not denying that I engaged in this conduct. And then if I could talk about this idea that the women's shelter is de facto a place where children gather, I think it's helpful to look at what is the trial court doing here when he's putting in this provision. What he's doing is following a statute that mandates that he do that. And so if we look at the statute and what this concept of place where children gather is, that is a factually rich concept. So the legislature, even for things like playgrounds or video arcades or youth centers, there are facts that go into that that have to show that that constitutes a place where children gather. For example, a youth center has to be intended primarily for use by people under 17 and has to regularly provide certain activities. Or a video arcade has to have a certain number of video machines in it and has to be intended primarily for this certain use. Even a playground has to have three or more PlayStations intended for the recreation of children. So we can't assume that these factually rich things are there. You know, the word gather means that you're congregating around some attraction or feature. You're coming together. And so we don't have evidence about whether or not that shelter even allowed children at all, let alone that it had some sort of feature that was causing children to congregate in the way that the statute and this trial court meant.
And so the trial court has made that finding, and we're looking at it purely from a sufficiency standpoint, correct?
We're looking at that from a sufficiency standpoint. Did they prove that it was a place where children gather?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you both for a well-done argument. The case will be submitted. Court's going to take about a five-minute recess, let the party switch out tables, and let our student guests stretch their legs for a second.